MSW Media.
News with swearing. Daily Beans, Daily Beans. Daily Beans, Daily Beans.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Thursday, August 6, 2020. Today, Sally Yates testifies before the Senate Judiciary Committee. Trump's hand-picked Inspector General for the State Department resigns. Kodak and their executive stock windfalls are now under investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. Why the Manhattan DA's subpoena of Mazars is worse for Trump than previously thought. The Pentagon contradicts Trump's statements about the explosion in Beirut, and Tennessee and Mississippi school districts are already closing down after increases in coronavirus cases. I'm your host, AG. Hello, big show today. We had the farce of a hearing in the Senate Judiciary chaired by Lindsey Graham Crackers with Sally Yates testifying, and I'll go over that in the lead. And I'll be chatting later in the show with Ellie Honig, former federal and state prosecutor, about his insights into the Manhattan DA's filing in the Trump Mazars subpoena case. It's worse for Trump than previously thought. And Jordan will be here for headlines from under the radar and the good news block. We found out also today that Trump did file a lawsuit against Nevada for their vote by mail bill. And I will be speaking to Andrew Torres about that filing on tomorrow's Daily Beans. So be here for that extended interview. We go in depth. And of course, please send your quarantine confessions and good news stories to us at dailybeanspod.com or quarantineconfessionspod.com. And with Jordan, that, we have a lot to get to today. So let's hit the hot notes. Hot notes. Donald Trump tweeted today, quote, Sally Yates has zero credibility. She was part of the greatest political crime of the century. And Obama Biden knew everything. He's doing Obama Biden as one word now. Sally Yates leaked the General Flynn conversation, question mark. Ask her under oath. Republicans should start playing the Democrats' game, unquote. He was, of course, referring to former Attorney General Sally Yates and her testimony before Lindsey Graham in the Senate Judiciary Committee this morning. Graham has slowly and methodically become one of the loudest proponents of the Obamagate conspiracy theory that the Obama administration was spying on the Trump campaign, and Sally Yates was clear in her answers today. It's almost like with Lindsey Graham, every time he goes golfing, a little bit of Nunes is deflated and a little bit of Lindsey is inflated, and all that crazy, all that conspiracy theory, nut job bullshit drains a little bit out of Nunes because we hear less from him. And or maybe he's just busy suing imaginary cows, and then gets pumped up into Lindsey Graham, and Lindsey Graham just becomes this big and just like untenable asshole. And so Sally Yates is testifying today, and when men on the Republican side would, you know, would ask her questions, they would not let her talk long enough. They would interrupt her. They would call her names, and they wouldn't stop interrupting her long enough for her to get an answer out. So she tried her best to answer these questions clearly. But this does solidify my belief that this hearing was nothing more than a political stunt cooked up by Lindsey Graham and Trump on the golf course to once again voice their insane theories about the Russia investigation, which have been disproven and debunked time and time again by this administration's own intelligence community. It's really, really quite astounding, these cherry-picked memos they decide to release. And the way that Yates was treated and spoken to was just rife with misogyny and disdain for strong female leaders. And that was overly apparent in the smug and condescending and patronizing way some of the committee members, especially Graham, Ted Cruz, and Senator Kennedy, spoke to Sally Yates. They would laugh when she answered, interrupt her endlessly, look away or leave when she was speaking. I remember one point when Lindsey Graham was done just asking his ridiculous questions and she was trying to answer the question. He just got up, drank his water, and just walked away. And they would repeatedly ask these front-loaded questions. And what I mean by that is these are questions the answers to which would presume like premeditated asinine conspiratorial predicates. It was really disgusting to watch. The Senate should be embarrassed over the actions of this committee, and the hypocrisy was astounding and on display for the world to judge, which I am certain they are. This is supposed to be our most deliberative body, and it was just absolutely ridiculous and embarrassing. And let's begin with Lindsey Graham Crackers. after his wildly inaccurate opening statements, accusing the Obama administration and Biden of spying on Flynn and unmasking names and spying on the Trump campaign. And that's how you know why Graham called this hearing at the behest of President Trump, by the way, because they kept bringing up Biden and what his role was in the Russia and Flynn investigations. Because previously, Graham was like, I'm done with Mueller. I'm done with the Russia investigation. I don't care about it anymore. But now that Biden is running for president and Biden was Obama's vice president, now it's back. And after Graham's incendiary opening remarks, void of truth, he opened the questioning with himself, as you do when you're the chair. There's nothing wrong with that. And he was just a complete asshole. Let's just listen to a bit of that exchange, and you'll see what I mean.
Now, let's talk about the January 5th meeting. Was the vice president there?
Yes, he was.
Okay. Did he mention the Logan Act?
You know, I don't remember the vice president saying much of anything in this meeting.
So you don't remember him mentioning the Logan Act?
No, I don't.
Did anybody mention the Logan Act?
I have a vague memory of Director Comey mentioning the Logan Act.
Okay, what was he mentioning the Logan Act about? In what context?
Well, I'm not sure if he mentioned that in the Oval Office meeting or in the meeting that he
What do you think about the...
Mr. Chairman, let her answer the question. Just because it's a woman testifying doesn't mean she has to be cut off.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Senator Lee. I really appreciate that. You're very constructive. So here's my question. Was the Logan Act mentioned in the meeting?
I recall Director Comey mentioning it at some point. What I'm not sure about, Senator Graham, and I want to be absolutely certain.
That's fair. That's fair. You don't know if it's mentioned in the meeting or not.
And what Graham was trying to get to in that line of questioning was if it was Joe Biden's idea to try to prosecute Flynn under the Logan Act. The Logan Act, if you remember from the Mueller days, the Kitchen days, says it's illegal for a citizen to act as an agent of a federal government with foreign governments if you're not in the government. And they were not yet in the government when these calls were made to Kislyak. The FBI and Mueller did not pursue Logan Act charges against Flynn, nor were they conducting a criminal investigation into Flynn at the time of his interview with the FBI. And it seemed many Senate Republicans don't grasp the difference between a counterintelligence investigation and a criminal investigation, or they do, and they're just being blatantly obtuse. And Yates pointed out that distinction on multiple occasions when she was allowed to speak. It was very frustrating to watch. You can hear it in my voice. I'd like to now go to Ted Cruz, Wolverine, and the overtly disingenuous structure of his questions, which beg predicates that do not exist. You'll hear what I mean. Let's take a listen to that.
Ms. Yates, when did you first become aware that the Obama administration was surveilling the Donald Trump campaign?
The Obama administration was not surveilling the Donald Trump campaign.
So a FISA application is not surveillance?
The FISA application was for Carter Page, who was a former member of the Trump campaign at that point.
So your testimony is that the investigation in Carter Page had nothing to do with the Donald Trump campaign?
No, I'm suggesting you asked me if we were surveilling the campaign.
You don't get it both ways. Is it the campaign or not?
Senator, I'm trying to give you what is the accurate information here. Carter Page was a former member of the Trump campaign at the time that the FISA was initiated.
And what was the reason for the FISA on Carter Page?
There were a number of reasons. First, we had gotten the information that I was trying to point out here, that the Russians had made the overture that they wanted to be able to assist the Trump campaign.
Now, Holder said it had nothing to do with the Trump campaign.
I said that he was not a member of the Trump campaign at the time that we initiated the FISA.
Ms. Yates, in your time at the Department of Justice, are you aware of any other political opponents of President Obama that were being surveilled?
Again, Senator, if you're talking about the court-authorized surveillance of Carter Page...
I'm asking, are you aware of any surveillance of any other political opponents, any other candidates for president in 2016? There were a whole bunch of them, including the chairman and myself. Were either of us being surveilled, yes or no?
The answer to that is no, and I also think that there was also no information that the Russians were working to aid another candidate other than Donald Trump.
Okay, so your testimony is no other candidate in 2016 was being surveilled other than Carter Page and the Trump campaign. Is that right?
Other than Carter Page.
Okay.
So you see how he keeps trying to make the surveillance of Trump campaign a thing? And it's not. He'll be like, so when you went to the store the other day and bought macaroni and cheese, you were spying on Trump's campaign and macaroni and cheese. Is that correct? Macaroni and cheese? Macaroni and cheese? And she, wait. We were not spying on the Trump campaign. She said over and over again, Carter Page was not part of the Trump campaign, nor was he charged with anything. It wasn't a criminal investigation. The FISA warrants were warranted, according to Inspector General Horowitz. We were doing a counterintelligence investigation. That's how you do when somebody's a fucking Russian asset. Anyway, next, we have the absolute undying idiocy of Senator Kennedy, who ends up insulting the former acting attorney general, Sally Yates, to the point of other senators having to intervene on her behalf. And this happened a couple of times during this hearing. As you heard in the clip, the Senator Graham clip and Senator Dianne Feinstein being, will you let her talk? And Senator Leahy, of course, being like, just because she's a woman doesn't mean you have to interrupt her every 5 seconds, which I thought was a nice touch. Senator Leahy, thank you. But Kennedy calling her names and just... Let's listen to a couple of exchanges between Sally Yates and Senator Kennedy. The first are just his opening questions. So you just get a gauge of this just sort of sets the tone. Let's listen.
You don't like Donald Trump, do you?
I don't respect the manner in which he has carried out the presidency.
Okay. You despise Donald Trump, don't you?
No, I don't despise anyone, Senator.
Okay.
And now let's listen to him calling her dumber than a rock. Let's check that clip out.
Buying the reliable source. Am I not like a rock, only dumber? Isn't that what you did?
No, that's not at all what I did, Senator. First of all, the FISA hearing.
So tell me every step you took to verify the veracity of the Steele dossier, which was junk. You didn't do anything, did you? Let me ask you one last question.
Yeah. If I could get a chance to answer your question.
Yes, ma'am. Look, go ahead.
Wait a minute, Mr. Chairman. Accusations are being made.
Sure.
The witness should have an opportunity to respond.
I agree. You may respond.
So Democrats got some questions in, including Senator Dianne Feinstein, who I think made the most important point of the day in her line of questioning in response to Lindsey Graham's repeated mention of the Logan Act and a non-existent criminal investigation into Flynn. She said, you know, we aren't here to find out if Flynn violated the Logan Act. We're here to find out if he acted without Trump's knowledge. And if he did act without Trump's knowledge, that's a counterintelligence problem. But if Trump knew, then we need to know why he was willing to forgive sanctions, especially after happily accepting all this help from the Russians in the campaign. So while Republicans were focused on their cherry-picked 302s about the Logan Act and Biden and whether the investigation into Flynn had ended before the FBI interview, the Democrats kept a big-picture approach. Flynn lied to the FBI and the Vice President of the United States. Russia knew that. That makes him vulnerable to blackmail by the Russians, and that's a bad thing if you're the fucking U.S. National Security Advisor. Just a thought. And it's surprising that it had to be kept having to be dragged back to that one glaringly obvious point. And speaking of the repeated assertions by the Senate Republicans that the FBI had no reason to question Michael Flynn, because we have notes here that say he, you know, that you had dropped the investigation into Flynn, Yates had to remind them multiple times that, one, the investigation into Flynn was a counterintelligence investigation, not a criminal investigation. And, two, the notes showing people wondering if they should drop the counterintelligence investigation into Flynn came before everyone found out about his calls with Kislyak about sanctions and the subsequent cover-up of those conversations. So shut up about the friggin' they were going to drop the... Yeah, they were going to drop it until we found out about the clandestine calls and the subsequent cover-up. Now, the hearing was a farce. I think Yates did spectacularly, as well as she could do, and all this did was illustrate the contempt for women this administration has, especially women with authority. I can personally attest to that. So, you know, watch it if you want. The Graham stuff was a little triggering, but honestly, it was... This is just political theater for the Republicans, for Lindsey Graham and Trump at this point. So, anyway, we'll be right back after this quick word with Jordan Coburn and more headlines from Under the Radar, so stay with us.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Today's episode of Daily Beans is brought to you by BetterHelp. Life is very strange right now. There's a lot of anxiety. People are out of work. There's a pandemic, and stress is at an all-time high. And if you're struggling dealing with these issues or any others that are keeping you from living a happy life, I want to recommend BetterHelp. BetterHelp wants you to start living happier today. It's not a crisis line. It's not self-help. It is licensed professional therapy and counseling done securely online. They will assess your needs and match you with your own licensed professional therapist, and you can start communicating in less than 24 hours. I personally dealt with trauma and PTS, and I'm a big believer in seeking help when you need it. And BetterHelp services are available for clients worldwide, and they have a broad range of experts in their network, which might not be locally available where you are. And the best thing about BetterHelp is you can log into your account anytime from anywhere and send a message to your counselor, and you'll get timely and thoughtful responses. And you can schedule weekly video or phone sessions, too. BetterHelp is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy and free to change your counselor if you need to. And it's more affordable than traditional offline counseling, and financial aid is available. Go to their website, read their testimonials, like this one from user LA, who says, "Ingrid is amazing. She's the best therapist I've ever had. They matched me with her on the first try. Can't wait to have our weekly talks. She listens when I need her to and gives the best advice when I need it. Since talking to her, I find myself having a better attitude in life, especially on therapy days." So visit BetterHelp.com/dailybeans. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, and join the over 800,000 people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. There's a special offer for Daily Beans listeners. You get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/dailybeans. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It is time for headlines from Under the Radar, all the news that seems to go missing from the mainstream, but we think is important for you to hear about. And joining me to discuss these headlines is Jordan Coburn.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing great. Just had some almonds, nice and hearty snack. Life is good.
Nice. How's the dog?
Oh, dog is great. Dog got groomed today. Yeah. She got her butt squeezed. You know how they do that thing for dogs, which was probably traumatizing for her.
Yeah, they call it anal gland expression.
Yes, expression. Mm. Such an artistic way to describe such a grimy, horrible thing.
Yeah. I expressed a pimple the other day, and no.
Precisely. Yes.
It came out and went, "Hey, I'm going to be a pimple today."
Exactly. It's the theater of hygiene.
I don't know why my pimples are Ethel Merman, but apparently that's what happens. All right. We have some news from Under the Radar. I'll kick it off with this story about the acting State Department Inspector General, Stephen Accard. Or Akard, I'm just going to say Accard. He has resigned after serving in the role for less than 3 months following the firing of the previous Inspector General Linick by President Donald Trump at the recommendation of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. As we know, Linick was investigating not only Pompeo and his wife's misuse of government funds for personal reasons, but he was also looking into the emergency arms sale to Saudi Arabia when Pompeo circumvented Congress to push that deal through. State Department Office of the Inspector General staff were told of Accard's decision to resign this Friday, but he's going to leave on Friday, in an email on Wednesday morning from one of the department's top officials. And this is according to a source familiar with the departure that spoke to CNN. It is unclear why Accard is resigning, although I can probably guess. But the email from Accard's deputy, Diana Shaw, said he would be returning to Indiana. That's all it said. The State Department and the State Office of Inspector General did not immediately reply to a request for comment. So interesting. We'll keep you apprised of that story as it unfolds. But I'm assuming a card got there and was read into everything that Pompeo did wrong and went, I'm out.
Yeah.
I don't know how you want me to stand up for this or not inspect this as the Inspector General.
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Yeah, or maybe he found out
wall.
About, you know, the, yeah, how he found, maybe he found out about the departure, the situation, you know, the events surrounding the departure of Linick, but either way, he's gone. I don't, you know, we could speculate all day, but, you know, when we learn the reasons, you know, we'll tell you. We're the beans.
You know, it's like,
Another effect of constantly having these people switching out in their positions is it becomes very hard for the American people to really hold anybody accountable in their brains, too. Because it's like the names are switching constantly. The bad actors switch constantly. And it's really hard to direct accountability at a moving target.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's got to be by design. So yeah. Here we are.
Yeah, totally. So on the topic of people trying to hold people accountable, Trump is facing some dissent from the Pentagon over his comments about Beirut's explosion being a result of an attack. And we haven't really gotten a chance to talk about it yet, what happened in Beirut, but the explosions, the videos are just insane. Have you got a chance to see any of those yet?
Yeah, and now they're showing some aerial views of Beirut and the destruction and just the absolute, you know, the scope of it is massive. And it was 2,700 plus tons of ammonium nitrate. And I think the Unabomber used 2 tons. And although some people were saying it's akin to a nuclear explosion, that was 15,000 tons, you know, because we're coming up on the 75th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima and the, you know, the flight of Enola Gay. And so I think a lot of people are going to be becoming attuned to, you know, the 100,000 people plus died in that attack. And so it wasn't that, but it did register a 3.3, I think, magnitude on the Richter scale.
Wow.
So it was like a small earthquake. It was massive.
Yeah.
And yeah, those videos are terrifying. Especially the one with the bride. Have you seen the one with the bride?
No.
Oh, this beautiful, beautiful bride in Beirut was doing a photo shoot when it happened. And I mean, she's okay, I think, but it was just a really devastating clip of video.
Yeah. I mean, it's coming out now that already over 100 people have died. There's thousands injured. 300,000 people are homeless right now because of all of the damage. It's so sad too, because there's this reality now that for a lot of people, they're just going to leave the city and probably not come back. And I was listening to NPR this morning, and the point was made that with that goes all of this talent, and just who these people are and what they contribute to the city is now just over, you know, for so many of these families. And it's a huge deficit that the city's facing now, just in so many ways. They were already facing all these upticks in coronavirus. Some of their ICUs were already almost at capacity. And then this happened, and they don't have the space to treat everybody. It's horrible. So Trump coming out and preemptively saying, you know, that it was an attack, or it looks like it was an attack or a bomb of some kind, it's quite irresponsible to say about a region that if that is, you know, the assumption that they wind up undertaking, you know, that would result in potentially them going to war. Like, these are not light words. If that was an attack.
Yeah, that's a statement of war.
Yes.
That's what he did. Absolutely irresponsible. And, like, devastatingly irresponsible.
Yes.
No one should ever make that kind of a statement. But now I guess what you're saying, the Pentagon's pushing back.
Yeah, Esper pushed back today, Wednesday. He was at the Aspen Security Forum, or it was online, and he was speaking, and he said that he was still getting information on the blast, but that most people believe that it was an accident, as reported. And not only Esper came out saying that, Pompeo also didn't say anything about it being an attack when he talked to Lebanese Prime Minister Hassan Diab. And so now it's Secretary Pompeo, this is a quote, Secretary Pompeo expressed his condolences to the Lebanese people for the horrible explosion at the Beirut port, which killed and injured so many and caused devastating destruction to the city. And that was really the synopsis of the call. That was the tone of the call. There was no language in there about, you know, hey, sorry about your terrorist attack, because that's not what it's being reported as having been currently. Then again, there's so many details that are still going to be going on. The investigations are like just, you know, starting. It just happened recently. And that's the point is that there's a lot of work that needs to be done to know exactly what happened. So don't run your mouth, President Trump, especially. Ugh, gross. I can't believe I just called him the president. I try to never do that. Don't get it out of my mouth. But for him to be in that position and just haphazardly labeling it as an attack is irresponsible, like you said, and Pentagon isn't letting him get away with it. They're not being incredibly forceful with their words, but they are setting the record straight in the speaking forums that they take up right now.
Yeah, it's interesting that Esper is actually sort of taking a stand by at least contradicting what the president insinuated in that press conference yesterday.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for that story. And again, our thoughts go out to all of the families and all the people impacted in Beirut by this absolutely incomprehensible tragedy. And seriously, I can't send enough condolences. I'm speechless about the absolute scope of the destruction.
Yeah.
From this explosion.
Yeah. So. They just really, really, really did not need this, especially right now. It's so devastating. It's just compounded devastation.
Yeah. All right. And next, a little bit, we'll move on here to kind of a good story, kind of a good news story. And that is that the Securities and Exchange Commission is now reportedly investigating Kodak. They're investigating how Eastman Kodak received a $765 million loan from the government to help make vaccine ingredients. And this is according to the Wall Street Journal. We talked about this a little bit earlier in the week, specifically these huge, massive stock windfalls that the executives were given. Last week's surprise announcement sent Kodak's shares soaring as much as 2,757%. And sparked heavy trading volume for the largely forgotten company. They're emerging from bankruptcy. Questions also arose about the executives, including Jim Continenza. This is the guy I was talking about a couple of days ago. He's the executive chairman and CEO, and he received stock options on July 27th, a day before the loan announcement. Regulators are reportedly investigating why Kodak announced the loan on the day prior to the official announcement, which sent shares 25% higher. The Journal, Wall Street Journal, said a local TV station in Kodak's home of Rochester, New York, published a media advisory of the upcoming announcement. And Kodak, in a statement on CNN Business, said it did not intend to make these details public until July 28th. However, the Journal reported Kodak didn't give the TV station an embargo on the announcement. As we reported, like I said, a couple days ago, that unusual deal with the government and the wild stock moves that followed caught Senator Elizabeth Warren's attention. And she said, quote, there were several instances of unusual trading activity prior to the announcement, raising questions about whether one or more individuals may have engaged in insider trading or in the unauthorized disclosure of material, non-public information regarding the forthcoming $765 million loan awarded under the Defense Production Act. And she wrote this in an open letter to the SEC on Tuesday. Kodak claims that the timing of the options was coincidental, and it taking place on the day of the board's compensation committee meeting, July 27th. Quote, Mr. Continenza has purchased shares at nearly every available window in which he's eligible since he joined the company. He has not sold a single share of stock during his time at Kodak. We will keep you apprised of this investigation by the SEC as it unfolds. So that's what's happening with Eastman Kodak. I can't even get it out of my mouth. I'm so mad.
Yeah, it's hard to keep your tongue in line when rage is feeling it.
Mm, yeah, buy Canon cameras.
Yeah, yeah. Seriously. My second story, is about what's going on in some school districts that are trying to reopen in the midst of COVID. Going to talk about Tennessee first. So they reopened, and some of their counties are already closing or severely moderating how they're attending school. So switching to that staggered schedule. So there's 50 school districts, nearly 50 school districts that started their school year as of Wednesday, and a majority of those school districts started in person. And there's been at least 14 confirmed COVID-19 cases connected to schools, and this is a really bad start to what was already a really shaky and not completely supported decision that the education department was making in Tennessee. Two school districts, Coffee County Schools and Blount County Schools, they've already closed or altered their schedules because of the virus. One district, they're closing for the remainder of the week after they were made aware of cases. And another, switching to that staggered schedule, like I said. And then in another county, there's a class of 16 students. students that have been sent home for a 2-week quarantine after someone that came into contact with them tested positive. And there's just case after case of staff testing positive for COVID-19 just all over the state. This is these are people who have attended in-person trainings or, you know, gone into the schools maybe to get ready for the start of the school year. And it is not looking good. Their governor, Bill Lee, he said Tuesday that his administration is in the process of creating a plan that's going to make it so schools can share the COVID-19 data with each other about what's going on in their facilities. And this is a switch up because previously the State Department of their state's Department of Health and their Department of Education said that their agencies would not ask for or collect data on the COVID-19 cases and deaths at each school because they were concerned, you know, about privacy. So Billy coming out and saying, no, we're actually going to work to make that information available is a switch. He said, we're developing a plan for reporting cases in schools. I believe that we have to protect privacy, but we also have to be transparent. And this is obviously the right call. And it's like privacy versus death is a pretty simple calculation in my book. I think if your personal business can kill people once it leaves your mouth, then I think those droplets become public information at that point. That's a really stupid thing to even take into consideration. This is like public health. The question of privacy, this is not the space for the question of privacy to limit what harm reduction policies states and counties and, you know, cities can implement. It's just not the time for that. Really quick, too, we're also getting reports out of Mississippi that they're not doing well either, and they're already seeing cases in their schools, too. So it's not looking great in that region.
Gosh, who could have predicted?
Yeah, exactly. And still Trump is going on his fucking pressers, you know, saying that, like, kids don't get infected. It's like they do get infected. What he's trying to say but intentionally not saying specifically is that, you know, when they get sick, because they do get sick and they do wind up transmitting the disease, they're less likely to experience serious complications and death than other age demographics. But that does not mean that they're not contributing to community spread or these other factors that make it so that it's harder to control the pandemic. And it's infuriating hearing him go on there and talk about this, you know, like kids are some sort of immune group when we know that that's not the case.
Yeah, he actually uses the word immunity. And yeah. And of course, you know, Dr. Fauci has come out and said that's not the case at all. And as we know now from reporting today, Dr. Fauci is now getting death threats. Even Deborah Birx, even the scarved sycophant, is now sort of turning on Trump, saying, look, if you don't have your community spread under control and you have a spike in cases, you shouldn't be going back to school. And yet Trump keeps tweeting. And so now we've got, you know, multiple mixed messages from our own federal government. And that is really bad news. We couldn't have had a worse leader in this crisis, I don't think. So, all right. Well, thanks for that update. And you'll stick around with me for good news in a little bit.
Yes, I will.
All right. Awesome. We'll be right back with former state and federal prosecutor Eli Honig. He's going to discuss his op-ed regarding the bizarre subpoena issued by the Manhattan District Attorney and why he thinks Trump is busted. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, it's AG, and this portion of Daily Beans is brought to you by Caliper CBD. We all need to practice self-care these days, but who said taking care of yourself has to be difficult? And what's great about CBD is it helps you feel better without making drastic changes to your routine. CBD has helped me feel more calm, I've been able to sleep easier, and I feel less sore after workouts or long, busy days. First, I was skeptical of CBD because, you know, droppers full of oil can't be the best modern science has to offer, right? Well, Caliper agrees, and that's why they've introduced a better way to consume CBD. Unlike oils, Caliper CBD is powder, and it's completely tasteless and mixes easily in food or drink, and there's no weird taste, and it's precisely 20 milligrams in each packet, so you'll never question how much CBD you're taking. I like to add it to my morning coffee or a post-workout smoothie, and it's clinically proven. You absorb 450% more CBD with Caliper CBD powder than compared to tinctures. And that's a huge difference, and they give you all the, it gives you all the benefits of CBD in just 15 minutes. It's fast acting. That's twice as fast as CBD oil. And Caliper comes completely THC-free with all natural, non-GMO ingredients, no fillers, no added chemicals or artificial flavors. You can get 20% off your first order when you use promo code DAILYBEANS at trycaliper.com/dailybeans. You can try Caliper CBD risk-free for 30 days, and if you don't love it, they'll give you a full refund. That's trycaliper.com/dailybeans, and don't forget to use promo code DAILYBEANS at checkout for 20% off your first order. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. As you know, we reported earlier in the week that the Manhattan District Attorney filed his motion to ask to dismiss Trump's case against his subpoena to Mazars, and for the first time publicly, the Manhattan DA disclosed he was looking for the 8 years of tax returns for more than just the hush money payments. He was investigating fraud within the Trump Organization going back at least that many years. And joining us today to go a little deeper and tell us why that should worry the hell out of Trump is former federal and state prosecutor Ellie Honig. Ellie, thanks for speaking with me today.
Glad to be back with you. Can I just say that as somebody who lives on the East Coast and has been without power for 24 hours, it just snapped back on. And man, you've never been more thankful for power than when you lose it for 24 hours. It is a wonderful thing. Air conditioning. God bless air conditioning.
Oh, yeah. We do out here in California on the West Coast, we have what's called rolling blackouts and rolling brownouts,
right,
where, you know,
right,
they just, the powers that be decide that giant swaths of the city doesn't get electricity for a long time because that's all we have.
I guess I can't complain given that, but man, it feels good when that snaps back on, let me tell you.
Yeah, congratulations. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I hope you all are staying safe out there. So
yeah,
in this piece that you penned for CNN, you address
yeah,
why the revelation that Trump is being investigated for tax and insurance fraud is a bigger worry for Trump than what we had, you know, I mean, we all knew he was being investigated for that, but it wasn't said out loud until this filing. And this is a big deal because it's not just the hush money payment scheme. And why is fraud a bigger threat to Trump than the hush money payment scheme?
Yeah. So two things are important about this. First of all, the response that the Manhattan DA put in on this subpoena issue shows me that they have something specific in mind. I did halfway suspect they're just poking around. They just want to see the financials because they're curious. They want to see if there's anything there. It's really not what you're supposed to use a subpoena for as a prosecutor. But look, we know that there are a lot of state-level prosecutors and prosecutors around the country who probably just want to get Trump some way or other. And I was thinking, are they just poking around here or are they focused and serious? This shows me that they're focused and serious.
And that was kind of Trump's argument too, right? It's overly broad. You're going back 8 years. You just want this hush money stuff. That was in 2016. Why are you going back 8 years?
Right. And keep in mind, that's an elected position. The DA, Cy Vance, has been rightly criticized roundly for a lot of the things he's done. He could be in trouble. And I thought, look, maybe he's just trying to show strong here so he can say, I stood up and I fought Donald Trump. And, you know, just with the, well, often that just means a subpoena.
Because what you're talking about is the fraud case that he didn't bring against the Trump children.
Exactly. Plus the way he was, I'll just say, soft on Harvey Weinstein the first time
yes,
through. We're talking about Cy Vance here, until the media pressure got to him and he charged him correctly later. He was soft on the Trump children. Cy Vance has a lot of problems, and I think he's had a very shaky tenure as DA. So let's start with that. But the bigger deal here is that they're not just looking at the hush money payments. And here, why that's such a big deal is because the hush money payment charge is really difficult to make and to prove. So let me just sort of summarize that charge for the audience. The essence of the charge is that it's a little bit different federal and state, but federally it's that the Trump campaign made these payments, and Donald Trump perhaps authorized them, to Stormy Daniels, to Karen McDougal, in order to silence them for electoral purposes. Now, I think there's a good argument that's why these payments were made. That the affairs were many years before. The payments were made just before the election. I don't think that's a coincidence. But the defense to that is always going to be, no, we paid these women either because they were shaking us down. That's what the Trump people say. They were threatening to go public. It wasn't true, but we didn't want to deal with the embarrassment. Or the common defense is, no, it wasn't for electoral purposes. It was to avoid personal embarrassment. It was to not drag my family through hell. And that's a hard thing to prove or disprove. And John Edwards, the former VP candidate, hard to believe, but he was charged with this, essentially similar federal crime years ago. And the charges did not stick because he essentially made the argument of, look, I had plenty of reasons for doing this. I'm not proud of any of them, but they weren't campaign related. I think there was even evidence in Edwards' case that he maybe continued paying after the campaign. So it's an intent-based crime. It's really hard to prove. And there's not really a neat analog under New York state law. There are very minor crimes for falsifying business records, but that is weak sauce.
Right. Everyone was looking at was that check that had been written. And then they said that the check that was used to reimburse Michael Cohen, who had taken a mortgage out on his house to pay this $130,000, that check to reimburse him was for legal work. And that is falsifying a business document. And we're like, bam, you got him on fraud. But you're right. Yeah. It's weak sauce. It was borderline misdemeanor. And so that's where we were at.
Exactly. First of all, it's a weak charge. I mean, especially, look, if you're going to charge a president, sitting or former of the United States, and we should flag whether a state can charge a sitting president, but you better have something a little stronger than a very low level felony or a high level misdemeanor. And look, they would just say the defense would be, look, we called it legal fees. I mean, construed broadly, like, it's a scuzzy form of legal fees. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not saying it's a great argument, but it's an argument. Now, though, what they appear to be looking at is really the overinflation and deflation of assets, which is, if they can prove this, and there seems to be significant evidence of it, then you're talking about what's really just like a textbook garden variety fraud case. So we've seen reporting and we've seen testimony from Michael Cohen, among others, that what the Trump org would do, and by the way, tell me if any of this comes as a shock to you that they might do this.
No, we covered this when the New York Times hit piece came out. And I say hit piece because it was awesome, which are big thanks in large part to the records that Mary Trump was able to turn over to the investigative reporters at the New York Times that said, yeah, we have evidence that he was inflating and deflating assets for different purposes.
Right. And so the allegations, and there is evidence, there's testimony of this, there's been public reporting, is that when it was time to get a bank loan, where you want to tell the bank, hey, I'm reliable, I have a lot of assets, they would artificially pump up the value of their assets, the value of their buildings. They would understate the liabilities. I mean, that is like fraud 101. That's the kind of fraud that if it didn't involve the president, you could give that to a third year prosecutor and be fine.
I could do it.
Yeah, you could. I bet you could. AG, I would give it to you. I'd probably put like another prosecutor on it to make sure you had it.
Oh, fine.
It's your first ever case. I mean, come on.
That it would be illegal for me to do it since I never taken the bar. But yeah, you remember, we all of our listeners will remember this really, really well. They saw it on Maddow. She put up a graph of a property, just one property value that was like 50, 20, 56 million, 291 million, and then back down to 70 million, you know, and there was this massive spike in property valuation, asset valuation on these forms that he filled out for this New York Times, not for the New York Times piece, but that the New York Times got a hold of.
Right. And then the flip side of that is they would, when it came tax time, of course, they would understate the value of their income and that kind of thing. And when it came to purchasing insurance, they would, I believe, overinflate so that if something happened, they would have I'm not actually sure which way that one goes, because I can see it either way. And I think I've heard it both ways. You can overinflate.
It might be both ways. They might have done it for both things.
If something happens, you get paid more. But you might underinflate it to keep your premiums low.
Right.
But either way would be a fraud. So this kind of fraud is much easier to prove. I mean, look, you can prove this on the documents largely, and you don't have to get into the really tricky question of, well, why did they make this payment? Was it to influence the election? Was it to avoid personal embarrassment? Was it to spare Melania embarrassment? I mean, all that stuff is off the table. So it's a much easier charge to make this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, I remember back in the day, many of us were concerned with the snail's pace of the courts on this issue because of the statute of limitations on fraud cases for felonies versus misdemeanors. But isn't it true, as it was in the Manafort case, that if you have a string of fraud over years, that it can all be roped into the charges? Because am I correct in thinking the statute of limitations clock doesn't start ticking until you stop criming?
Yes, for the most part. So yeah, if you carry out a conspiracy or a scheme over however many years, that clock does not start running until the last day. So that's generally the way it works. For tax returns, it's a little different. The clock starts running when the return is filed or when it's due or something. But they are going to be up against the clock here. And good for the DA. They're pushing hard and they have a good judge. This is Victor Marrero, who's in the SDNY. I appeared in front of him. And he obviously understands the import of this case. I mean, he ruled decisively against Trump the first time through. And I want people to understand, this is still that Supreme Court case. So The Manhattan DA served a subpoena on Mazars USA, which is Trump's financial firm. That's the one where the Trump defenders said, no, 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 we have absolute immunity. You can't even investigate the president criminally while he's in office. Judge Marrero said, what, are you kidding me? He called it, he had some very strong language rejecting that. The Court of Appeals, Second Circuit, rejected it. And then the Supreme Court rejected it 7-2. But remember, when that happened a few weeks ago, they sent the case back down. People said, well, what does that mean? That meant that the Supreme Court said, okay, Mr. President, your argument that you're special or different because you're president, we reject that. Now you can go back down into courts and argue against the subpoena like any normal person would. And let me tell you, normal people who get criminal subpoenas almost never defeat them. The technical term is quash them. It is extraordinarily difficult. So that's the argument we're seeing now. It is not looking good for Trump. I don't like to turn these into wagers, but if I had to wager, I'd be comfortable wagering a couple bucks that Marrero sides with the DA here and upholds the subpoena. Trump is not going to defeat this subpoena. He's just not.
No. Yeah, no. I have got money on that, and I've got money on the en banc hearing in the Flynn mandamus case too.
Sure. Yep. Well, that's when the whole court decides we're going to rehear this, that's a pretty good tell that they don't like what this was.
Yeah, it's not just a vote of four like SCOTUS certiorari. It's no, right. And we're vacating that last thing because we're going to hear it. But finally, before I let you go, it appears that this, to me, is the actual Operation Warp Speed. Tell us about this pretty fast briefing and hearing schedule. And I also want to know, how many times can he do this? What happens if the court says, no, I'm dismissing Trump's case? Is that the end of the line or is it Appealsville again?
Yeah. So first of all, the warp speed that we're seeing here is a good illustration of something I've been pounding the drum about, I think on your show as well, AG, which is courts are human beings. Courts are judges. There seems to be this notion out there, oh, the courts are so slow. And they are. I get it. I get that frustration. But you know how fast courts can move? As fast as the judge damn well wants.
Yeah.
And judges, you know how hard it is for a judge to move a case to the top of his docket? As hard as it is for the judge to go, I'm going to pick up that red weld right now. So judges need to get on this, and prosecutors and others who are pushing for these things need to push judges. I mean, Nadler's case in the court, he's just sort of, you know, left it in their hands, maybe said, I'd like a quick ruling. But you have to be insistent. You have to make sure that the judge understands. I think the judges understand here. That's why we're seeing very quick turnaround, matters of days and weeks. So here's what's next. Let's say the district judge, Marrero, says, I uphold the subpoena. Certainly the Trump people will then appeal it to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. They may choose to hear it. They may not. It's what's called an interlocutory appeal, meaning it's not appealing a final conviction. But if the Second Circuit does hear it, then I believe they're going to move quickly as well. And then if the Second Circuit rules to uphold the subpoena, which I think they will, then the Trump people can seek certiorari from the Supreme Court. But I doubt the Supreme Court takes this, because the original question about the scope of presidential immunity was definitely Supreme Court worthy. But now it's just your standard old criminal subpoena. And there's no way the Supreme Court's going to take up a question about a just straight up criminal subpoena. So we're probably looking at
even though it's the president of the United States.
Yeah, but now he has to defend it on the same basis as anybody else, because they've already rejected his I'm president, I'm special argument. So so I think we're looking at Marrero, who's the district judge who has it now, and then probably one round of the Court of Appeals. I mean, look, there could be a ruling on this. I don't know. I mean, we're early August. By end of September,
I think it's August 11th, right? Is their hearing? Is that right?
Right.
August 11th?
Right. Understand, though, even if this issue is decided and the subpoena is formally upheld, that does not mean we, the public, see those tax returns right away. That does not mean the Manhattan DA will be returning indictments right away. There are a lot of other factors at play, but tax returns won't become public unless someone leaks them, but that would be illegal because they're grand jury records.
Yep.
In contrast to Congress, who can leak and does leak all the time, but we wouldn't see those actual tax returns unless and until the case went to trial. So, there's a lot for Trump to be worried about here, but the tax, this is probably not how the tax returns are going to become public, certainly before the election.
And all we would see would be the proof of inflating or deflating assets for the purpose of defrauding the IRS or defrauding insurance companies or defrauding banks. That we wouldn't see like, his loans were undersigned by Russia through Deutsche Bank, or because that's not what the Manhattan DA is looking at here.
I mean, but they would see that if it was there, right? I mean, if they get the tax returns, they're going to see everything that's in it. So, yeah, but their focus seems to be that overinflation, underinflation aspect. Yeah,
exactly. All right. Well, thanks for explaining that to us. It's really interesting because we had, you know, I hadn't been considering the intent part. And, you know, that word rears its ugly head in prosecutions, and it has with the Trump administration going back to the Mueller investigation. So I can totally understand why a straightforward, you know, that Manafort, that's what happened with him. And it's just a much easier case to prosecute. So thanks for explaining that to us. Tell everyone where they can find you.
Let's see, Ellie Honig, ELIEHONIG, as I like to say, I'm the only one on Twitter. And I'm doing, by the way, I'm trying to get a little cooler. I'm doing Instagram now. My daughter actually kind of approves of Instagram. So if you want to see like more, my kids and me, you know, goofing around and stuff, that's Instagram. But the business side is Twitter.
Awesome. Well, thanks very much for joining us. Former federal and former state prosecutor Ellie Honig. We look forward to having you back on when this continues.
Thanks, AG.
All right. We'll be right back after this with the good news block and Jordan Coburn. So stay with us. Hey, friends. It's AG. This segment of Daily Beans is brought to you by Helix Sleep. Like many people, I've experienced a variety of sleep issues. Night sweats, trouble falling asleep, anxiety, my mind won't turn off, tossing and turning. And oftentimes I would wake up tired and sore in the morning, and at first I thought my insomnia was caused by stress and anxiety. You know, especially with Trump having access to the nuclear codes, despite not being able to pronounce words like Yosemite. But, as it turned out, my problems were getting restful sleep actually were caused by my mattress. But everything changed with Helix Sleep. You've heard me talk about it before. You've heard Jordan talk about hers. You've heard Joelle and Mandy talk about their Helix mattress. Helix Sleep understands that you're unique, and they customize the mattress to fit you in the way you sleep best. They created a sleep quiz that takes just 2 minutes to complete, and they use the answers to match your body type and sleep preferences to the perfect mattress. If you like a mattress that's really soft or firm, or if you sleep on your side or your back or your stomach, or if you sleep really hot, with Helix, there's a specific mattress for each and everybody's unique tastes. Like me, I was matched to the Helix Midnight because I like my bed medium firm and I sleep on my side. I'm a side sleeper, so it's perfect for me. But you don't have to take my word for it. They were awarded the number one best overall mattress pick of 2019 and 2020 by GQ and Wired Magazine. Just go to helixsleep.com/dailybeans and take their 2-minute sleep quiz, and they'll match you to a customized mattress that will give you the best sleep of your life. They have a 10-year warranty. You get to try it out for 100 sleeps risk-free, and they'll even pick it up for you if you don't love it. But you definitely will. Helix is offering up to $200 off all mattress orders for our listeners at helixsleep.com/dailybeans. That's Helix, H-E-L-I-X, sleep.com/dailybeans for up to $200 off. Hey, everybody, welcome back. It is finally time for the good news. Well, we'll float on, good news is on the way. And back with me for the good news is Jordan Coburn. Hello.
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 Hello. How are you?
It is nice to have you back for the good news block today.
Yes.
I'm well, and I'm about to be better because our good news from our listeners always, always, always makes me feel better. Mm-hmm. So do you want to kick it off? Do you want to start with Paul?
I'd love to. Thank you. From Paul, pronouns he, him. I am a paramedic. Thank you, Paul the paramedic. In Massachusetts, we've been holding our own here and have defiantly invoked the declaration, COVID-19, go fuck yourself, and have not been deterred since March. Personally, I knew shit was going to go down in January, and thanks to MSW reporting, we bought provisions and stayed home in February before mainstream media started doing its job. However, my 12-year-old son lives out of state with his mother. I had not seen him since Christmas time due to getting the flu and COVID-19 guidelines travel restrictions. Fast forward to this past June, his mother tagged me in to have him for the summer until September, or when school foolishly begins. Don't get me started. His mother has done an incredible job dealing with a sudden at-home curriculum and her own college studies. She needed a break too. We've taken the high road and are taking co-parenting seriously. I love to hear that.
Nice.
I baseline always miss him, and I'm in a general state of worry. Sure, he's accessible with FaceTime or a short 3-hour drive from where he is in New York, but my general state of anxiety has been heightened, as I'm sure everyone else's anxiety is as well. But having him for the last 3.5 weeks has been a joy, and I have never slept better having him here. Plus, there has been more quality time because expensive pastimes are shut down for the summer. There's been a lot of going to friends' pools and private places to swim. I've turned him on to Python's Holy Grail and Slapshot, good old 12-year-old appropriate humor, and a lot of new music. New in quotes, because he goes on to list Beatles, Stones, Who, etc. You know what I'm saying, AJ. It's nice because he's not on a free-for-all dad's going to spoil this shit out of me vacation. We have to do chores, summer reading, mandatory 2-mile walks with dogs in the morning, and proper daily washing, which is an issue, nasty young boys, before he gets his mainlined Xbox fix for the day. Anyway, just being a full-on dad during a pestilence has never brought me so much satisfaction and pride. Having him see me go to work while the world is on fire, I hope, will register somewhere in his brain, and he'll think of it when he doesn't want to go to work when he's 40, fingers crossed. One of the great joys in these times has been watching movies. I relish teaching my son my favorite, the Count of Monte Cristo quote, "You will bask in the sunlight one moment, be shattered on the rocks the next. What makes you a man is what you do when that storm comes. You must look into that storm and shout as you did in Rome, 'Do your worst, for I will do mine.'" Maybe a silver lining in all of this is that if they don't go to school in fall full-time, I can have him here in Massachusetts while Zooming school lessons during the months I normally don't get to see him as much. Being a paramedic affords me a lot of time off between shifts. Maybe it's a silver lining. I don't know. But it's made me and my wife closer as well. She's a pharmacist and been dealing with madness and anti-maskers as well. Oh, God, I'd be so fucking annoyed as a pharmacist dealing with anti-maskers. Jesus Christ. Even though she's not his biological mother, she's been wonderful with him as well, helping out while I'm at work for my 24-hour shifts. I'm just so content, at least I think it's contentment. It's a new feeling, a paradox in these strange times. I'm grateful for my son, my wife, my health, my career, my friends, and that we live in a state, even with a Republican governor, where scientific and enlightenment principles are respected, valued, and adhered to. I feel like Minnesota Fats, Jackie Gleason, during the opening pool match in The Hustler, where Fast Eddie, Paul Newman, thinks he's got Fats licked and is up. Fats takes a break after hours of playing. He's all disheveled. Fats takes a bird bath and washes his face and hands, combs his hair, fixes his clothes, and says, "Fast Eddie, let's shoot some pool," and whoops Eddie's ass after another marathon pool hustle. Do your fucking worst, COVID-19, for I am doing mine. I fucking love you guys. AG, Jordan's Confused, and Mandy Reedy, you're all so smart and funny and bursting with empathy. All of you work so hard and it shows. I thank you. Thank everyone else behind the scenes for me and my family. Paul. Thank you, Paul.
Damn, Paul.
Yeah, seriously.
We got The Who and Monty Python and Slapshot in there. We got a little Fast Eddie Felsen from The Hustler. Yeah. Wow.
Also, thank you for being a paramedic.
And a quote.
Yeah, that was a great
And a quote,
quote
from The Count of Monte Cristo. What a great quote. Yeah. Yes, and thanks for being a dad and a husband and a paramedic. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very good news.
Yeah, it sounds like you and your ex-wife are doing a lot of really good work. Sorry, that was an assumption. I think you said ex-wife. But yeah, just doing the work to keep it together, which is so important for a kid, especially that age. And I think that is really commendable. So from one sad divorce kid to a sad divorce dad, good job. Or content. You're content now. Let's revel in the content. I gotta give you that. Yes.
That's the good news.
Yes.
Next up from Shelby. Shelby writes in, pronouns she, her. Hey there, Beans fam. Shelby here. Happy face. I've been listening since the kitchen days, and you've really been helping me understand and feel so informed on everything that's been going on. Admittedly, I was very inactive in politics prior to 2016, but you guys have been there for me and the rest of us who have been yearning to catch up and keep up. So thank you. Per the standard, a short intro. When the protests started just a little while ago, I was having a really hard time letting my mind rest. I cried more than I ever cried. I felt so helpless because although I'm a person of action, I could not go out and protest. I'm considered an essential worker who travels for work, and I desperately need my eyesight to remain fully functional to keep my job. I've been trying to do as much research, reading, listening to podcasts, supporting businesses run by POC, people of color, and watching movies, documentaries as much as possible. And I know it doesn't make up for my past ignorance, nor does it feel as important as the work of the people on the ground to everyone who is able to go outside and protest. Thank you. The good news is this. The other day, I listened to the podcast episode where you guys were introduced to APA, the sky bison, and I thought I would fill you in on what that is and where it's from, the source of my inspiration to share. It sounds like you guys have not seen Avatar, The Last Airbender, the animated series. Definitely not the M. Night Shyamalan movie. Please do not watch that movie. Really, this short series is now streaming on Netflix. I'd highly recommend it. Because of the stress due to the overload of information, being away from home, and the feeling of helplessness, I started to rewatch the series. I'm no poet, but in plain words, it has a beautiful animation, a wonderful plot, fantastic character arcs, and a lesson worth learning. I really cannot talk this up enough. It is probably the most wholesome TV show I've ever watched and helped me cry happy tears in these sad times. It also reminded me of being home, as we have an APA of our own, Sea Attachment. She truly lives up to the name, and she is the best friend kitty of all of our cats, and she loves snuggles, naps, and eating, just like the character in the show. I wanted to share this in hopes you might watch the show and that it brings you as much heartwarming kid-like joy as it does for me. Fair warning, there are at least 3 episodes that will make you cry. The love that they are able to show in this series is just too much for any heart to handle. Anyways, I hope this is good news story has found you all doing well. I do appreciate everything that you guys do. It can be so hard carrying on doing something where you don't see the direct results of the hard work that you're putting in. Your good news stories have been helping me as well, making me cry happy tears, especially the hockey story from almost the very beginning. They are a much welcomed break from the stress, fear, anger, etc. that I've been going through. Please keep it up as long as you can. Much love, Shelby. P.S. Also mentioned in the name of the episode, I think. I don't know if you've heard this, but someone termed the Matt Gaetz and Company incident lactosing the intolerant. You're welcome.
That's perfect.
And then look at the kitty. Oh, it's a flame God. Point.
Wow.
It's a flame point. I had a kitty exactly like this, chonkers, flame point, cross-eyed, blue eyes. And his name was Dipstick because when he was a baby, he was white and fluffy, and the end of his tail was orange, and he looked like a dipstick, you know, aww, how you check your oil. And so, and he was kind of, you know, derpy looking with his crossed eyes. Yeah. So it was Dipstick.
That's and, so funny.
This baby, he looks like mine was part ragdoll too. So he was just sort of a floppy kitty, you know, where they just put him wherever you put him. Mm-hmm. They just go. I love him.
Oh my gosh.
Thank you.
Yeah, seriously. I'm so glad that the good news is lifting you up that much. I love hearing from you all how much you like this segment. Feel the same. Next up from Sarah, pronouns she, her. Sarah says, I live in a battleground state. My county is extremely rural and most of the election officials are 65 plus, so there is a poll worker shortage. I signed up to be a poll worker for the general election and was accepted. I'll be in full PPE.
Yay.
Yeah, and while I admit I'm a bit nervous about being around so many people, I'm also glad to be a part of this election. It makes me feel less frustrated and like I'm contributing something useful to my community. Also, my ill-advised home haircut, Dee Dee Ramone Banks, have grown out enough to stop having to wear scarves and hats in all my work Zoom meetings. Scarves and hats. It's July. Or now August.
Like, it's cold in here. It's cold.
You're like, oh, I've relocated to Australia, everyone. Sorry.
I love it. Dee Dee Ramone Bangs. I call them, I got this off of one of my hairdressers. He calls them institutional bangs.
Yeah.
Because of the movie Girl Interrupted and the tiny little short bangs that Angelina Jolie had in that movie.
Yeah.
And then also in one of my comedy bits, I call them vegan bangs because
yes,
the girl who volunteered at the Planned Parenthood where I was a regular had vegan bangs. So, you know what I mean when I say vegan bangs.
I love those bangs. It takes everything in me to not cut my hair like that. Yeah, I love those bangs.
Except you have curly hair, so they would just be all like wonky.
Yeah, I'd have to straighten them every day.
And it's hard to straighten those little tiny short baby bangs. It's hard.
Yeah, totally. I just like cinch my forehead. I just have like a friggin' Frankenstein scar halo.
They just fan out like something about Mary, but short.
Yep.
Well, thank you for that.
Yes.
And Let's see. Next up from Meredith, pronouns she, her. I've been a longtime listener starting in the days of MSW and have always meant to become a patron. Have to say, I'm so ashamed it's taken me this long. I volunteer for a local pet rescue, all for one. I love a good pun. In my town, which, by the way, was originated, planned, built, and implemented by a binder full of women, quote unquote. So shout out to women. I foster litters of puppies, and my morning routine, which is critical to my survival, is to greet the puppers, make coffee, and listen to your podcast while I let them out to play and commence cleaning up the poonado that usually occurs overnight. I realize that with most of my recent litter that I cannot live without you ladies, so in honor of each of these seven pups, I have paid for sponsorships for seven people. Enjoy. Thank you so much for keeping me current. So very educated. I was wondering who that was. It was you, Meredith.
That's
thank
so
you.
Nice.
Thank you.
Aw.
In case you're wondering what Meredith's talking about, we have a program now where you can, if you can swing it, you can buy a patron sponsorship for someone for a year for $36. And, you know, then they get the access to the ad-free episodes and the book club and, the, you know, coming on to the happy hour early, all the stuff patrons get, newsletter, research notes. And we've got a huge mega response to that. And we still, and, you know, we've got a lot of people on the waiting list waiting for these because, you know, there's a lot of folks out there who want to be patrons but can't quite swing it. So thank you, Meredith, and thanks to all of our patrons who are buying these one-year subscriptions for people who can't do it right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, seriously. That's so cool. Thank you. Next up from Anna. Anna says, this is to give everyone out there some hope that change is happening. This lady I worked with for years has brought me to tears several times in the last several months. She went from drinking the MAGA Kool-Aid to being an active anti-Trumper, anti-racist, and all-around amazing person. Yes!
What?
God! She lives in the Deep South, and both her family and her in-laws are very conservative. She attends a conservative church, and she is generally surrounded by very conservative people. So for her to stand up and loudly push back with love, kindness, and facts is truly amazing to see. If she can find the bravery to be disowned by her community, some really have disowned her and cut her out of their lives, and not only change, but speak about how and why she changed, I have hope for our nation. This woman was always amazing in many respects, but her recent transformation is what I cling to when I feel like I want to shut down. If she can stand up for what is right, so can I. So take heart, all. There is change happening. I love hearing those
yes.
stories. And I love that YouTube channel of freaking, like, remorseful Trump voters for the same reason. It is just so nice to see that there are people with
yeah.
functioning hearts in this world.
Yeah, and there was, yeah, like real life Grinches because their hearts grew three sizes.
Yes.
And there's also now a hashtag called Lincoln Voter. And that is that was a hashtag started by the Lincoln Project, which, as you can imagine, are former Republicans who are now going to vote for Joe Biden. So you can check out a lot of really, like, uplifting, you know, if you're scrolling through Twitter and you're, you know, feeling just overwhelmed by all the shittiness, you can just go to hashtag Lincoln Voter and look at a bunch of Republicans who have changed and are going to be voting for Biden.
Mm-hmm.
It is uplifting. And you're right. Change is happening. Did you see that that video posted by the guy who got pulled over by the cops and was shocked and pleasantly surprised to see a white woman filming him from across the street, mm-hmm. filming the whole cop interaction from across the street?
No.
And he was like, all right, allies, I've never seen this before.
No.
Change, this is different. This is different. And it's awesome. So, I think that what's most satisfying, at least for me, is the speed with which these changes are happening as opposed to in the past.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Filming the police is a huge thing that you can do for sure. And it's like,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't hurt anybody. That only serves to help.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. So thank you for sending in your good news stories. We appreciate it. If we didn't get to yours today, we'll get to it tomorrow. We'll get to them. We will. And if you have more good news stories, send them in at dailybeanspod.com and click on contact. That's where you can submit that. You can also submit quarantine confessions. We need those. And you can submit corrections if you find that we've made an error, or you have something that you want to contest with us. Anything that we said in the pod, we're open to the corrections. And, you know, we will be back tomorrow.
All right.
Any final thoughts, Jed?
No, not for me.
All right. I know I left a little pause there. It was the anticipation of the final thoughts question that I was trying to... I was trying to do a like Damocles final thought sword over your head. All right. Well, with that, then everyone, well, until next time, please take care of yourselves, take care of each other, take care of your mental health, and take care of the planet. I've been AG.
I've been Jordan Coburn.
And them's the Beans. The Daily Beans is executive produced and directed by AG and Jordan Coburn, and engineered and edited by Mackenzie Mazzell and Starburns Industries. Our marketing manager, executive assistant, production and social media direction is Amanda Reeder. Fact-checking and research by AG, Jordan Coburn, and Amanda Reeder. Our music is written and performed by They Might Be Giants. Our web design and branding are by Joelle Reeder with Moxie Design Studios. And our website is dailybeanspod.com.